Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Program, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience and our audiences online and on the radio to hear Bridget Ford speak about the bonds of union, a time before the Civil War when there was an attempt to create a more inclusive society, won't say more than that, and that, of course, the Civil War disrupted that fairly significantly for over 100 years, and now we're trying again. And now it's being disrupted again. So Bridget Ford is a professor of history at California State University, East Bay. Her bachelor's degree in history is from Barnard, and her PhD is from UC Davis. And she's here to talk about her book, Bonds of Union. Thank you, Bridget.
Good evening. First things first, I have a confession to make here tonight. For the better part of my adulthood, I've been studying the history of two states in the Civil War era, Ohio and Kentucky. I understand that it must seem like a quixotic life pursuit. But in this region of the United States before the Civil War, I found evidence of a profound story, and I felt like I couldn't let the story go untold. So here we are tonight. The story is one in which people faced straight on the most fundamental questions and challenges that we've ever faced as a nation. More than any other Americans at the time, the residents of these two states thought through in the most closely reasoned way what the responsibility of government was to end slavery legally and militarily. The residents of Ohio and Kentucky confronted the full horror of American slavery, both as a lived experience and as a moral test. Slavery was not an abstract question for them, but a palpable, visible reality, evidenced most clearly in the continuous, sustained movement of enslaved people from Kentucky into Ohio. The individuals I'll be speaking about today argued with cogency and power that the Constitution did not recognize the right of property in man. This idea guided Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party from its founding and through the Civil War. The people I studied went still further to define what the conditions of freedom would look like for Black Americans. They did so under the most stressful of personal circumstances and under conditions of great social strain, violence, and war. I wouldn't claim that they got everything right, but I've also tried to understand the difficult setting in which they lived and worked. This work, their work, was the story I most wanted to tell in the book I wrote. By way of introduction, let me note here that although I greatly admired these individuals, they also perplexed me. Here's one such individual, William Gibson of Louisville, Kentucky. For me, Gibson opened up the history of an era in a radically new way. He's like what Alexander Hamilton was to Lin-Manuel Miranda. As a young man, he moved from Baltimore, Maryland, to Louisville, Kentucky, to open high-quality, rigorous schools for both free and enslaved children. Gibson had been a gifted, precocious child and was selected out for special tutoring by leading ministers in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. But at the age of 19, Gibson read a job advertisement for a teacher, an advertisement placed by a Black church in Louisville. The church wanted a school teacher who was, quote, desirous of benefiting his race. He applied. He got the job. And he proved a perfect match for the church and the school. For the next decade, he taught hundreds of free and enslaved children and some adults in schools located in the heart of Louisville. Open, visible, deliberately unafraid of the city's slave masters and slave patrols. For a long time, I couldn't figure out why a young, free Black man with one of the best educations his era offered, would remain in the slave South. Wouldn't any of the northern free states have been more appealing to him than Kentucky? Why slaveholding Kentucky, of all the places, for such a promising young man? I thought about this question quite a lot through Gibson and as a larger inquiry. What do you do when confronted with profound injustice? In many ways, this book is an effort to answer that question. It took a long time for me to piece together the answer, partly because the evidence can very easily slip away from sight. As just one example, here is Gibson's autobiography, which was published in 1897. It would have been easy to dismiss this history of the United Brothers of Friendship and Sisters of the Mysterious Ten as a really odd work of 19th century ephemera having little to do with the Civil War, which ostensibly was my topic of research. But then, on page 115, we have the start of Gibson's personal history, an autobiography and a history of a city, a state, and a nation joined into a single narrative. When I saw that Gibson was a, quote, participant in the joys and sorrows of his people, I knew he had a story to tell, and I knew he would tell it very well. Throughout his narrative, his writing has a spare beauty and directness. For example, he defined education as the thirst for light. And I found that Gibson got his first Wikipedia page in October of 2016, so he's just coming to be known, I guess, to the world. This evening, I'd like to explain how Gibson's narrative helped me rethink one of the most familiar arguments about the United States Civil War today. You'll surely know this argument, that at the beginning of the Civil War, President Lincoln and Northern states fought for the limited goal to preserve the Union. Then the war goes very, very badly. The Confederacy proves a formidable opponent. Its generals were surprisingly good. So Lincoln and his cabinet begin to consider emancipation, that is, ending slavery to weaken the Confederacy militarily. And I'm going to be using these three phrases interchangeably, ending slavery, emancipation, and abolition. And I'm more or less using them in the same meaning, to end slavery. But Lincoln still moves slowly, reluctantly even, to accept emancipation as a military necessity. Finally, in 1862, Lincoln, out of desperation, issues the Emancipation Proclamation. In this familiar argument, the proclamation itself remains an imperfect attack on slavery, partial and predicated on future military victories. In other words, the proclamation offers further evidence of the Union's deep resistance to ending slavery. Maybe Lincoln and the Republicans had moral qualms about slavery, but when push came to shove, they had no real plan to end slavery, according to this argument. And you don't get much credit today, I think, for vaguely stated feelings about a wrong. You need to act on that sentiment. In this familiar argument, the response of the federal government to one of the nation's most profound injustices was tardy, inadequate, and with a gun pointed at its head. Beyond the problem of inaction, since preserving the Union maintained the status quo, including slavery, this objective almost looks morally indefensible from our perspective today. In spite of these distressing implications, this familiar argument is everywhere you look in classrooms and popular accounts of the Civil War. Here are some examples. This is the 2016 History Social Science Framework, and this is going to be guiding teachers in kindergarten through high school in teaching history and social science, but particularly particularly history. And let me just say that I love this new framework. I think it's fantastic. It really encourages teachers to take students into really deep inquiries about the past. It's very cutting edge. I think some of us who are teaching at the college level would be do well to take some notes from it. But on the Civil War, we find this. At the war's beginning, the purpose of it was not to end slavery, but to reunite the Union, reunite the nation. From a recent college textbook, the vast majority of Northerners went to war to preserve the Union. But the war ultimately transformed into a struggle to eradicate slavery. This familiar argument also enters into widespread public consciousness through popular historical writers, such as the Fox commentator Andrew Napolitano. Now, Napolitano seems like an affable guy. He's very chummy with Jon Stewart. But when he includes the familiar argument, it takes on a very sinister tone by adding just one word. And so here are some quotes from Napolitano. Lincoln cared solely about preserving the Union, not freeing the slaves. Another quote, slaves were freed in the South only when it was clear that a proclamation of freedom would aid the Union psychologically, economically, and militarily in its victory over the Confederate South. And another sentence, he writes a lot about this. Lincoln only supported an end to slavery when he felt it became necessary to win the war. As a libertarian, Napolitano deeply distrusts government. The familiar argument about the Civil War is a way for Napolitano to demonstrate the federal government's moral failing, even as it was facing its greatest test of survival. And he includes it in this book called Lies the Government Told You. His point, if you ever thought Lincoln or the Union wanted to end slavery before 1861, you've been under a delusion. Since there's little difference between the more neutral history social science framework and Napolitano, most readers will find little to critique in Napolitano's wording of these events. Whether coming from liberal universities such as UC Davis, where the history social science framework was crafted, or conservative thinkers such as Napolitano, this understanding of the course of the Civil War, first preserve the Union, next abolish slavery, is pervasive. With so much agreement, the argument seems like it must be right. In the course of my research and in writing this book, I've become convinced it's wrong. That was Brian that did that. Now, before you decide I've gone out on a limb here and that I can't possibly disprove this familiar and pervasive argument in the next 35 minutes, let me help my case by showing that I'm not the only historian working to overturn this thesis. James Oakes is perhaps the most prominent historian working today to reconsider the first Union, then emancipation argument. And just so you don't think we're out on a fringe, his book, Freedom National, won the prestigious Lincoln Prize in 2013, and that's funded by a quite mainstream institution in New York. In fact, we're in a moment right now where many historians are working hard to recover the history of emancipation, anti-slavery, and the nature of slavery itself. My work and the work of James Oakes is part of that larger effort. So if you read Oakes, what will you find? First, he argues that we have a logical or interpretive problem. If everyone agreed about slavery's place in the United States, then preserving the Union would have been an easy proposition. And here's a corollary. If we can't find any moral purpose at the outset other than preserving the Union, which could have been easily accomplished, then the violence of the Civil War seems unnecessary. Neo-revisionists like Napolitano today go further to suggest that slavery could have ended peacefully. He even states that Lincoln tricked the Confederacy into a war, placing blame for war on the Union. That's fringe history. But I fear it's making inroads, since that idea might logically follow from the familiar argument. Oakes upends this fringe history by offering a persuasive alternative to the familiar argument. According to Oakes, with Republicans in control of the White House and Congress, preserving the Union comprised a blueprint for ending slavery through two possible means, one legislative and the other military. Here's Oakes' main evidence. And let me note here that this evidence is discussed across about 600 pages in his book, so I'm just giving you a very quick synopsis. From its founding in the early 1850s, the Republican Party waged an unabashed attack on slavery. In fact, as Republicans took possession of the White House and Congress in 1860, they brought with them two deeply considered strategies that they believed would end slavery in the United States: freedom national policies and slave emancipation during wartime. Well, before the Civil War, the architects of the Republican Party insisted that the U.S. Constitution did not recognize a right of property in man. According to Republicans, the Founding Fathers deliberately planted a freedom principle in the Constitution. In consequence, the federal government had an active duty to strengthen that freedom principle everywhere it could through legislative means. This has been a little hard for us to understand because Republicans often said that they couldn't tamper with slavery in the states where it already existed. But even if the federal government couldn't outlaw slavery in, say, South Carolina, it could act to ban slavery in places where it held exclusive authority, in the Western territories, on the high seas, on the waters, and in Washington, D.C. If the federal government surrounded slave states with freedom, if it built up freedom everywhere it could, then slavery as an economic and political system would not last, they believed. To use their terms, Republicans were placing a cordon of freedom around southern states, putting slavery on a path of ultimate extinction. It was a strategy of containment to make slavery more and more difficult to sustain within individual slaveholding states. Led by Republicans, northern states also made it extremely difficult for masters to recapture fugitive slaves who made it to free soil. And these states passed anti-kidnapping laws to protect free African Americans from arbitrary slave catchers. This fundamental idea and the practical policies behind it became a political party slogan for Republicans: freedom national. More than a slogan, it embraced actions that federal and state governments could and did take to reinforce the freedom principle in the Constitution. What Oakes shows is that Republicans' constitutional thinking produced real live policies and actions intended to destroy slavery. Now, if this blueprint for containment didn't work, Republicans had another plan in mind: wartime emancipation. In time of war or domestic disturbance, governments had the power to emancipate slaves. This had already occurred many times over. In the American Revolution, slaves gained their freedom. In the War of 1812, masters were not compensated for slaves who gained their freedom through British wartime emancipation. Most strikingly, in the early 1840s, U.S. generals liberated hundreds of slaves during wars with Seminole Indians in Florida, and the U.S. government honored the military emancipations with legal freedom. Drawing on this recent wartime history, Republicans argued that Congress had the power to destroy slavery, recognize slave status as persons, and arm them in a military conflict. These two ideas, Freedom National and wartime emancipation, were firmly set in Republicans' minds as the two best means by which to attack slavery. And they had refined those two ideas for two decades before the Civil War. So when the war broke out, they were prepared to implement both ideas. And according to Oakes, they did so relentlessly from the beginning. Not after the war went badly, but from the beginning. As a consequence, slave liberation began almost immediately, within days of the Confederate firing on Fort Sumter on April 12, 1861. By August of 1861, just 4 months later, Congress had passed, which Lincoln quickly signed, a law ensuring slaves' liberation during wartime, and the War Department acted aggressively to enforce the act. After August 8th, all slaves coming to Union lines in rebellious states would be emancipated. Over the next year, this first Confiscation Act liberated tens of thousands of slaves. It's hard to imagine this happening any sooner. There was no time gap between the start of the war and wartime emancipation. These two things were simultaneous events. In the new argument, war for union was always about a war for emancipation. It's impossible to disentangle these things. In Oakes's phrasing, from the very beginning, Republicans insisted that slavery was the cause of the rebellion and emancipation an appropriate and ultimately indispensable means of suppressing it. Where does my work fit into this? One starting point for me was a simple word, union. It's not a term we use today to describe the United States. No one uses it as a form of patriotic affection. And yet, to me, the shorthand term we use today, America, US of A, seemed diminished relative to the word union. Union seems just to have a little bit of poetry within it, a little more togetherness, a little less pure patriotism. I especially wondered how union had become such a dangerous, tainted word in 1861 that 11 slave states would wage a vicious war against it. Then, as I tried to figure out the meaning of union before the Civil War, I found another phrase used all the time by Americans in the 1840s and 1850s. And this is bonds of union. It's a stilted phrase. We would never use it in our everyday speech today. But I found that 19th century Americans used the phrase quite a lot. They used it in definitions of faith and religious community, in political speeches, in anti-slavery literature. Lincoln used the phrase several times in the 1850s in his most important speeches, asking, "What are our bonds of union?" By 1858, he was insisting that slavery's constitutional protection was not one of the nation's bonds of union. But why use this odd phrasing? At one level, I found it fascinating because it seems redundant. By itself, union means the action of joining or uniting one thing to another. So why do you need more bonds for something that's already doing the work of joining? Here's what I found in my research. Americans were in a unique moment in which they were steeped in ideas of union and bonds of union. They were really trying to find a means to step outside the self, to understand people, things, and experiences beyond their own person. The first third of my book looks at religious concepts of union, the urge to seek soul union, as they called it, with the divine, for example. People also knew the biblical phrase from Colossians, put on love, which is the perfect bond of union. If ideas about union started with faith, Americans pushed the concept into other realms. In matters of race and lived experience, Americans in the 19th century felt impelled to look at the world from other people's vantage or perspective. Today, we often speak of practicing empathy across racial, religious, or economic divides. We talk of listening to each other, of walking in each other's shoes. But I'm convinced we don't have an easy political way to speak about this. We have a hard time connecting what we know is an emotional or affective imperative to our political contexts. We house our emotional connections in community, but this is almost always separate from government. In the 19th century, the affective or emotional connections were held together in the idea of union, and even more so in the idea of bonds of union. In fact, thinking about bonds of union demanded a powerful imagination to figure out how to join one thing to another. In my book, I look at this imaginative process in religious faith, in relationships between Black and white people, Black and white Americans, between soldiers and civilians during the Civil War. That is, in places where there were profound gaps and terrible failures in understanding. This imaginative work had practical consequences. The individuals I studied set several critical public institutions, schools and courts especially, on a course towards recognition of the essential equality and dignity of all persons, regardless of background, origin, or skin color. And they did this before the Civil War. These changes help account for why slave states violently withdrew from the Union in 1861. It was because the Union signified a flexibility on race and culture and an ability to imagine, build, and sustain institutions free of the hierarchies of skin color. I'm going to try to explain the connections here and the meaning of union through three individuals, two Black and one white. The three men include Salmon Chase in the center here. If you have a Chase credit card or a bank account, it's his name that oversees your access to cash and credit. You might also know Chase as a member of Lincoln's cabinet during the war and later as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He was a key founder of the Republican Party, the state of Ohio's first Republican governor, and the most radical voice for African-American rights in Lincoln's administration. The other two men are John Gaines of Cincinnati and William Gibson of Louisville, who I had introduced earlier. There are biographical similarities between the men. All were very serious about their educations. They gained early notice for the power of their intellects. All three studied and wrote histories to understand their own personal lives in connection with the traumas of slavery and civil war. Both Chase and Gaines lost their fathers when they were around the age of 10, and they really had to fight for their educations after that point. What I want to stress here is that you cannot understand the biographies of any one of these men apart from the other two. So let me just give a quick rundown here, and then I'll speak about each of them a bit individually. Chase worked with Gaines to establish public schools for African-American children in Ohio and knew well the Black churches where those schools were first housed. Gibson traveled to Cincinnati to hear Gaines speak, then modeled his public school system for Black children in Kentucky on the one Gaines had founded in Ohio. Chase financially supported emancipationists in Kentucky who aided Gibson's anti-slavery work in the 1840s and 1850s. Their work and accomplishments are inseparable stories. Because of their dedicated work, Union could stand for inclusion and equality by 1861.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California.
Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
John Gaines's family had direct knowledge of slavery. His mother, Elizabeth, had been enslaved in Kentucky. Elizabeth had three children by her master, the first pregnancy taking place when she was 14 and her master nearing 40. This master died, willing Elizabeth her freedom along with all of her children, excepting inexplicably her youngest child named Elliot. So Elizabeth moved with her freed children to Cincinnati, but is forced by the vagaries of slavery to leave Elliot behind. In Cincinnati, Elizabeth marries a free black man, and John Isom Gaines, their child, was born in 1821. When John was 6 years old, that youngest child from whom Elizabeth had been separated finally joined the family, and he had been apart from his mother for a decade. John Gaines had as good an education, as he could have had at that time. His family instilled in him an appreciation of education early on. His father, Isom, attended a night school to learn to read at the age of 45. John attended schools run by abolitionists in Cincinnati until his father died of cholera in 1832. John's formal education was sporadic after that, and he eventually became a fairly prosperous grocer. John Isom Gaines was a very special person, though. He studied history. he went to political meetings. He himself became, he was speaking at these meetings at the age of 16. He was kind of a wonder kid. He gained fame. He once dined with the legendary and sort of quirky anti-slavery Kentuckian Cassius Clay, who tried to tempt Gaines with a glass of wine. Gaines refused, and he never once in his life apparently took a sip of alcohol. And this, I think, is because he had such an intense, focused vision of what freedom should look like for African Americans. Through his short life, Gaines fought with every fiber of his being for public schools for all children. This was no simple, inevitable development. Gaines really had to fight two battles. He first of all had to stop this colonization movement in its tracks. He traveled up and down the state of Ohio declaiming against the idea that black Americans should emigrate to West Africa, as many white Americans believed at the time. More than anyone else in Ohio, Gaines kills off the colonization movement. Next, he had to get the Ohio State Legislature to fund the schools, and he had to get localities to actually put the monies into the hands of black school boards. He had to build the schools, hire the teachers, persuade families that they should send their children to these schools. He had to create black school boards, get voters out to select leaders for the schools. This was the first formal right to vote that black men enjoyed in Ohio. All in all, what Gaines did in his short life was stunning. The state of Ohio was investing in black lives and minds. And here's one measure of that achievement. 7,000 children in 159 schools by 1860, from only 950 in publicly funded schools 8 years earlier. It's okay. Gaines's schools were not narrowly technical or practical. He really wanted to see the fullest classical education for African American children with history, literature, advanced math, science, music, gymnastics. These schools were very recognizable to us in the breadth of their education goals. Gaines spoke of education as a kind of enlightenment project, and he wanted to see Black intellectuality as an emblem of democracy's wisdom and grandeur in human history. He gave everything to this effort. He died at the age of 38, just after having attended a school board meeting. It's really quite stunning. He actually, by the time he was 38, he couldn't walk. And he actually had friends carry him to a school board meeting. And that was just at the very end of his life. His funeral was attended by 3,000 people. We should be so fortunate. So Gaines couldn't do this work entirely alone, of course, and it required legal and political allies, the most important of which was Salmon Chase. Chase squeezed the school funding out of the Ohio legislature in 1849, and then his law firm provided the lead attorney for Gaines when Cincinnati challenged the legality of the schools and the Black school boards. Here's that lead attorney, Flamin' Ball, who has one of the worst names I've run across in the 19th century. And like his name, Flamin' Ball's portrait is not flattering. Of course, Salmon is also an odd name, and Chase wondered why his parents named him something so fishy. It makes me chuckle to think about these two lawyers arriving in their office in the morning to start the workday. Good morning, Salmon. Good morning, Flamin. Flamin and Salmon. It's a very improbable combination. Anyhow, Salmon arrives in Cincinnati as a young man, trained as a lawyer in 1830. Soon after arriving, he writes this enormous history of Ohio and its laws, looking really closely at the Northwest Ordinance, the act of the founders to ban slavery from the territory that became Ohio and other Midwestern states. He contracts cholera and nearly dies while writing this history, but keeps on going. These were very intrepid people. By 1837, he was representing fugitive slaves in courtrooms and making the crucial constitutional argument that underpinned the Republican Party's freedom national strategy. According to Chase, there could be no such thing as a slave in Ohio because of the prescience of the founders. Moreover, nothing in the Constitution specifically required a northern state or a northern individual to be a party to the return of fugitives to masters, in his view. Slavery did not and could not have any presence beyond the borders of the existing slave states. Chase was denationalizing slavery. By protecting freedom in Ohio, Chase believed he could undermine slavery in a place like Kentucky. And he really acted on this view in Ohio. One scholar argues that Chase launched a civil rights revolution in Ohio in the 1850s. He helped legislate into being Gaines's public school system. More than that, he forced the repeal of discriminatory laws that restricted the rights, the civil rights of African Americans. And I think it's important to note here that Chase knows Cincinnati's African American community fairly well. His law firm provided all manner of legal services to Black Cincinnatians, and he visited churches and schools in the city. Based on this experience as governor in the late 1850s, he pushed through laws establishing harsh penalties for trying to kidnap free African Americans. Ohio also would not prosecute anyone who helped individuals and families trying to run away from slavery. Chase was making Ohio a sanctuary state. He hoped this would make slavery more difficult to maintain as a legal system in southern states. But Chase didn't just try to imperil slavery from the free and safe state of Ohio, safer state of Ohio. He also tried to attack slavery from within the slave states themselves. Through the 1840s and 1850s, Chase financially and politically supported an Emancipation Party in Kentucky, a party made up of Native Kentuckians. Anti-slavery folks like Chase thought if any state was going to make slaveholding illegal, it would be Kentucky. So we finally come back to Gibson. This explains why Gibson wanted to be in Kentucky. He wanted to be part of the movement that brought slaveholding to an end in a state south of the Mason and Dixon line, south of the Ohio River. In Louisville, Gibson kept black Kentuckians apprised of the anti-slavery movement in the North. He subscribed to Frederick Douglass's newspapers, had them secretly shipped over across the Ohio River. He traveled to meetings to hear Douglass and other anti-slavery politicians speak. He brought the news and ideas back home to Kentucky to share with others. He put an interesting twist on his anti-slavery politics in Kentucky. Gibson was an artist. He was a very serious violinist with classical training, and he formed a Mozart Society with German immigrants in Louisville. It was one of the most popular musical attractions in the city. In addition, he formed a choir in his church, which was made up of free and enslaved African Americans, free and enslaved Louisvillians. He taught this choir how to read music and then invited white political leaders to watch the choir perform. And Gibson made sure his choir members, whether they were enslaved or free, held notebooks with the music lined out so that white audiences saw black people reading complex forms of musical expression. This was rather ingenious because all the white visitors came away convinced that black Kentuckians were ready for freedom with their evident capacity for education and, quote, civilization, as they called it. White Kentuckians actually wrote rather effusively about these performances in newspapers as they argued for emancipation at the time in the state. But Gibson's most important achievement was in establishing public schools for black children in Kentucky. He went to hear Gaines speak in the 1850s and learned how black Ohioans were getting a public school system established. Gibson kept up his private schools, which, like Gaines, were full-fledged classical schools with advanced subjects of study, science, math, literature, the whole gamut, PE, too. He later wrote about that time, quote, "We were feeling our way, aiming for a higher plane of civilization." When the Civil War concluded in 1865, Gibson was ready to lobby for and roll out a new public school system. And he knew how to do it, having watched Gaines's fight. Here's what he did. From 1,000 children in private schools, paid entirely by parents, to 2,000 children in publicly funded schools within 8 years of the Confederacy's demise. Gibson felt this was his greatest accomplishment. At the end of his life, he wrote proudly, "We have thousands in attendance in the schools in Louisville, over 100 teachers, 9 buildings, and a high school." Although his autobiography is not exactly religious, reflecting on this achievement, he wrote, "Praise God, from whom all blessings flow." Let me just touch on a couple of things here with respect to some possible military consequences. I think in part because of Gibson's work, Kentucky, a slave state, doesn't look like the Deep South. It remains with the Union. Kentucky's one of the four so-called border states that are shaded in yellow here because they border the free North, which is shaded in pink. Had the border states joined the other 11 slave states, shaded in green, the Union would have had a much more formidable opponent in the war. Instead, the four border states remained with the Union, thereby dividing the slave states. Instead of representing 15 states, the Confederacy represented 11 states. This division of the slave states made the Confederacy considerably weaker and more vulnerable. More than 24,000 African American men in Kentucky enlisted in the federal armies, which was almost 60% of all black military-aged men. That's an astonishing number and a larger percentage than any other southern state excepting Louisiana. Those enlistments came at a critical time, mostly in 1864, and helped the Union move more swiftly to victory over the Confederacy. Gibson helped set the stage for these enlistments. He briefly acted as a recruiter for black troops to join the 55th Massachusetts in Louisville in 1863. But more importantly, he provided black Kentuckians with a sense of what freedom could look like so that there was a future to fight for beyond emancipation. The point I want to stress here, though, is this. Even in 1861, Union was always about ending slavery. Preserving the Union did not mean preserving the status quo. Men like Gaines, Chase, and Gibson had breathed new life into the meaning of Union before the Civil War began. They had compelled the states of Ohio and Kentucky to invest in black lives. And they did this before and immediately following the Civil War. They had turned critical public institutions, schools, courts, and political parties into agents of freedom and equality. During the Civil War, the Republican Party didn't come to the idea of emancipation tardily, dragging its feet, reluctant and besieged, and upon threat of national dissolution. The idea and principle of equality was infused into their work to preserve the Union always and from the beginning. In this way, they made the Union stronger, more able to withstand the onslaught of war and emerge victorious. People like Gaines, Chase, and Gibson had actively transformed the Union's meaning in concrete and visible ways. In fact, their vision of an inclusive democracy was precisely what the Confederacy most feared and waged a terrible war against. We need a better narrative about the causes and course of the Civil War, one that is truer to the history of men like Gaines, Chase, and Gibson. That better narrative would show American institutions, the Constitution, courts, schools, political parties, trying to right the nation's greatest wrong. With that truer narrative, we might feel less cynicism and more hope about our fundamental American institutions, and especially about the capacity and responsibility of government to redress the inequalities that we can so readily see today. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Professor Bridget Ford speaking about her book, Bonds of Union, about pre-Civil War attempts at an inclusive society. It's time for questions. Anybody would like to ask the first question?
Ms. Ford, I have a question about Kentucky. My understanding is that Louisville was a free area, but the rest of the state remained having slavery during the Civil War. Is that true?
No. Louisville was a part of the slave state of Kentucky and actually was a prominent city for the domestic slave trade. So there were slaves moving through Louisville all the time and domestic slaves in the city.
So as a follow-up, it must have took a tremendous amount of courage for a guy like Gibson to start a school in Kentucky.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, wow, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, literally, there's a possibility someone would capture him and make him a slave again?
Yeah, I mean, he has, don't get me wrong, he has some misgivings about this choice over time. Particularly after 1850 with the Fugitive Slave Act, he considers leaving Kentucky, but he stays. He did leave for a period during the war itself, but he came back to establish those schools in 1865. So he's just gone for a brief time. So,
and,
yeah, it was hard.
And finally, when did Kentucky become a free state?
Not until 1865, but late 1865, with the ratification of the 13th Amendment. But slavery is unraveling in the state much earlier, from as early as 64. I mean, there are men, former slaves, enlisting in Union troops, federal troops, in 1864. So, for all intents and purposes, the system's being undermined in the course of the war, as Lincoln called it, the friction and abrasion of war is undoing slavery. You cannot have war going on. I mean, in every war, slaves pursue their freedom, and it was impossible for even those neutral or slave state. Border states, border slave states, to maintain slavery in the conditions of wartime.
And then finally, after 1865, Mr. Gibson must have felt like he batted on the right side, or was he like patting himself on the back? Or?
Well, he's a very dedicated, dedicated Republican after the Civil War. In fact, one of the things I learned in the Wikipedia page, actually, was that he served in the U.S. Secret Service. I know, and investigated a Klan murder as a Secret Service agent. He definitely was, a great supporter of the party. But the Reconstruction era is nevertheless a very trying, difficult era. He was worked for the U.S. Postal Service and did face himself some Klan violence. So I think, he was writing in 1897 his autobiography, and I think he wanted to make sure people knew. I think he's writing in a moment where he's wondering about things. He wants to almost reassure himself that this story has been important.
Okay. Why did you say there were four slave states? Weren't there five?
A border states?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, there are initially four, and then there are five with West Virginia.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I hope I got that answer right. Thank you, Hudson.
Thanks. I thought it was just terrific. I have a question about Kentucky, and it follows on that quotation you've just given from Lincoln about how the mere frictions and abrasions of war will end this institution. I mean, one of the things Lincoln, I think, is trying to do in the war is he realizes or he fears that wartime emancipation won't stick. And that somehow, at the end of the day, in the Freedom National narrative was that states, nonetheless, even though freedom was national, states that had slavery were the only agents that could abolish it. So in order to abolish slavery properly, you needed a constitutional amendment, which needs you need three-quarters of the states to ratify an amendment. So what he's doing through the war, as you know, is he's trying desperately to put together states that will be able to pass a 15th Amendment. And one of the things I've never been able to understand is he's writing to people in the border states, and he's offering them the kind of compensated emancipation that had happened in District of Columbia. And it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's in the context of one of those letters where he writes to people in Kentucky. He says, look, you're going to lose your slaves anyway through the mere frictions and abrasions of war. Will you just do the right thing and take the deal? And so I guess what I'm wondering about is if the political culture of Kentucky is as you're describing it and of other border states as well, why are they so recalcitrant on this? At the end of the day, I mean, Lincoln's prophecy is right. They don't bend. They hang on to slavery. They lose everything with the 15th Amendment.
So with the history of Kentucky, I feel that the understanding of that border state comes through the minds of the slaveholders of Kentucky. And I feel like the story of Black Kentuckians has not been brought into that narrative, who are naturally, inherently anti-slavery. The slaveholders are... they're unwilling to move along with this. Absolutely. I mean, they're deeply opposed to emancipation. They remain so. In that respect, Louisville is a distinctive story. And maybe that goes back to the earlier question as well, that in Louisville there is an emancipation movement, and there is an anti-slavery movement that persists through the 1850s. The Republicans are persuaded that if any state is going to abolish slavery, other than maybe Delaware, it's going to be Kentucky. And I think they hold on to that hope a little bit here. But yeah, Kentucky remains a very difficult state for the Republicans through the war. I mean, they're kind of this hornet's nest for the Republicans throughout. So I think that's a valid assertion. I mean, it's a very difficult state. But I think there are multiple stories within Kentucky, and different, depending on where you look in Kentucky, there are different things happening. One thing I worry about, though, is that the stories that exclusively hinge on what the slaveholders say versus what, say, the, you know, African-American Kentuckians say, I fear that that story hasn't been in place. Yeah.
Thank you. Ms. Ford, if you could probably, in your research of the antebellum South, I was just wondering if you ran into kind of the economic complicity of the border states and the North in maintaining the institution of slavery when it fit their model, and then opposing slavery when that model, for a mix of reasons, became unsustainable. If you were to ask a Southern historian about, you know, why the rebellion occurred, it always boils down to the economic capture that Southerners felt from the financial and banking institutions that Mr. Chase and others of that sort were operating, that they were held economic hostage. And I was just wondering if during your research, and particularly the antebellum period and during the war, if you found any merit in that argument. Thank you.
So the argument that the economic hostage, state one more time for me the question. I mean, if I could have you.
Sure. If you look at how Southerners viewed the war and their motive for gaining their exit from the Union, one of the lead arguments is that they were economically not able to sell their goods, not to have a protective tariff, all the other things that the union. So I just it almost seems like it was a natural consequence of Northern complicity that created the ultimately South Carolina and the rest of the states from exiting.
So if you look at the Declaration of Secession from South Carolina, it is not about economic issues directly. It's really about the what they believed was the failure of the northern states to abide by the fugitive slave law. That is the vast majority of that statement of why South Carolina explaining why they seceded. Now, obviously, that has an economic implication for them, but they said that the Union was breaking its compact because it was it wasn't compelling the northern states to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. I mean, I guess you could read that as an economic argument, but it's really about the reinforcement of slavery. So I don't feel like they're not talking about economic impositions in the Declaration of Secession. They're just not. They're worried about Northern sentiment. They feel that Northern sentiment is moving against slavery and putting it on this. They actually use the phrase, Northerners are putting slavery on the path of ultimate extinction. And therefore, we cannot be a party to this. So that's how I would read it literally. I wouldn't read subtexts below that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Over here, yeah. So before West Virginia, what were the four original border states? It's a little simpler.
Missouri, Kentucky, Delaware, Maryland.
Thank you very much.
Did I get it? Okay. All right.
Thank you. Yeah.
I have a simple question. Right now, we have blue states, red states. We think about it this way. But, of course, we know that the percentage of voters for and against something is much, much closer. Is there any historical evidence about what percentage of the northern people were in favor of emancipation and what percentage of southern people were? Because it might be 60-40, 40-60 or something rather than opposite. Is there any evidence around for that?
Well, I mean, you can look at the number of voters for the Republican Party would be a good measure. I mean, it depends what point in time you're looking at, but one of the most common measures of anti-slavery or emancipation sentiment is the 1864 election, which is really seen as a referendum on the Emancipation Proclamation. And Lincoln got he got about 80%, I think, of the soldiers to vote. But that would be a good measure of sentiment. He was truly worried he would lose that election. He was very concerned about that. But he won. So, I mean, looking at those election returns is one good measure of things. Well, okay, yeah.
Dr. Ford. Dr. Ford, wonderful talk.
Hi, Dr. Ivy.
Nice to see you. I have a question for you. I want to return the conversation to the myth that you opened up that you said was wrong, and then you had the nice little red circle with the line through it come through. That idea that the war was primarily about preserving the Union, only secondarily out of desperation about ending slavery. I was wondering if I could ask you to hypothesize a bit on how that impacts us as contemporary Americans with this understanding of our past? In other words, does it have some sort of impact on us that we think that it really wasn't all about slavery? It was about something different. And how is that, how does that have sort of a cultural impact on us today?
Well, I think that's what I was getting at the conclusion there, that I think to have the Union so reluctant to pursue emancipation, even as it's in this great test, I think makes us wonder, well, what is the federal government supposed to be doing here? And I think it leaves us with very few examples, big examples of the federal government doing something right because they should do it. And I fear that we don't have a good, I don't know if moral is the right story here, but a good political story of the Civil War era. I think that the Republican Party and the politics of the party were driving towards emancipation in some form or another. And when the war broke out, they built on that one, you know, in a series of policies. And I think what we're left with is a story of Lincoln, either as a reluctant emancipator or as the great emancipator, but we don't have a story of our politics, our system of governance moving towards an emancipation. I think that takes away from, well, first of all, it leaves us with the great man theory, either a great man or a failing man, one of the two. But I think if we had a better sense of the capacity of politics to make great change, we would feel more empowered by that and a little less like nothing can ever get done kind of thinking. So yeah, I think it's a really, to move away from the familiar argument, I think can make us see that a political party in particular with a clear and close reasoned way out of a problem can make some strides on that potentially. I mean, can make good on its promises and its beliefs. And I think we have a hard time believing that at this moment.
We have time for one more question.
Yeah, I maybe you answered that part of it right now, but this is a great research you did, historical research you did, I don't know if that's part of your research to see how to apply this historical research as a lesson learned. To know what's the main lesson learned point right now and how it can be applied today.
Well, historians aren't so good about applying. It's a great question. I think as a historian, we try to help people understand the past. I'm not sure what the applied lesson is. I suppose that's for our students to take and imagine and to think about. It's true that as historians and academics generally are more removed today from active participation or visible participation in politics, I'm not sure if we have an... we're out there. I mean, we're at meetings and marches and so on, but I think we're less visible as public intellectuals than we have been in the past, and maybe it's time to correct that a little bit, but I don't have any applied lessons except to believe that American institutions do have the capacity to change and that Americans are more flexible, more susceptible to change. I think to know that is true of the past can gives you a greater sense of capacity in the present. So I talk about that in my classes.
And maybe for... Maybe for California and San Francisco, having the idea that sanctuary cities sometimes worked against the grain over time might be a useful applied idea. Thank you very, very much, Professor
Thank you.
Ford.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much for coming. And so ends another event in the 115-year history of enlightened discussion at the Commonwealth Club.